Hey, it's Sam Alai here, founder of My Legal Academy, where we help lawyers scale and automate their law firms so they could sign up more clients and reclaim their precious time. If you're looking to grow your practice while working less, click the link in the show notes to book a free call to discover a radically different way to grow your law firm. Enjoy the episode.
There's a critical difference between being a great lawyer and being a great leader. And that is the gap that is costing women in law millions in lost revenue and opportunity. Today, we're bridging that divide and exploring what happens when women stop practicing law and start leading it. This isn't about becoming a better attorney or managing your caseload more efficiently. We're completely reimagining your role from technical expert to visionary leader, from service provider to strategic CEO. The most successful women in law aren't just excellent attorneys, they're powerful leaders who drive their firms forward with clarity, purpose, and authority. Catherine has engineered a remarkable evolution from skilled practitioner to formidable leader of a thriving legal enterprise. She's here to share the unfiltered truth about what this transformation really requires and why it's the only path to creating the impact, income, and legacy you deserve. Right. Welcome back to our final episode of the Built to Lead series. I am super excited to have you as our guest, Catherine, as our last episode. So if you want to take a moment and just introduce yourself, and then we'll dive in.
Wow. Thank you for having me. And I'm excited to be the last episode. I'm Catherine O'Connell. I'm actually a New Zealand and UK qualified lawyer, and I'm based in Tokyo. I'm the founder of a law firm here, but I'm the first foreign female to found a law firm.
Wow.
Yeah.
That is shocking. It's amazing, but that is like super shocking that like that's not a big thing, I guess.
A lot of women before me, but yeah, that's what happened. And I didn't actually set up in that way to be the first. I was told afterwards, you are the first. And I'm like, okay.
Great. Oh, wow. So you didn't even know that's like amazing.
So I had worked for over a couple of decades with global Japanese companies, and I saw how legal teams were really overstretched, especially solo GCs. And I thought they need some support, but sometimes they just don't justify within their, you know, their budgets that they can have a full-time hire. So I do this kind of service, a fractional GC service to them. And that's sort of quite unique in Japan still. So I'm not just an outside lawyer. I help them as one member of their team alongside the business people. And as well as that role of my running my firm, I'm on a couple of boards. I'm on Toyota and Fujitsu. I also host a podcast, Lawyer on Air, and I spotlight women lawyers working in Japan, foreign and Japanese. Yeah, and I'm very careful about sharing.
So I have to ask you, do you speak the language? Oh my God, that's amazing. I guess it would be kind of hard to do that if you didn't, right?
It'd be hard. I think there's the biggest question people ask is, do you need Japanese to be successful in Japan? And for me, it's certainly been my, you know, magic sauce, but I don't know if it's everybody's. Yeah.
Well, being the first, leading us into this conversation, which for me, the leadership conversation around women in general is a big thing for me. It's a big part of the thing that's near to my heart, because as women, especially lawyers, you guys are generally alpha. You're type A. I'm a type A alpha. That's just how I think. And it's always something that there's pushback on. There's always, you know, you're too much, you're too aggressive, you're too this. And your leadership needs to look a very specific way. And I think what I found working with lawyers is that there's that missing leadership piece for women where they either not sure how to lead or feel like they have to lead the way that, you know, male counterparts do. And I think that it's a big conversation that needs to be had. And I think the biggest thing is that law school doesn't teach anyone how to run a business or how to lead an organization. So my first question to you would be, how did you gain those technical skills and learn to really lead your own firm?
Oh, such a big question.
It's a fun one.
I did look around and think, well, I'm not the same as my counterparts around the world, around the community and where I was. And, you know, I'm probably less alpha and more working through from pillars of connection and curiosity and empathetic leadership. So I, of course, did the study and the qualifications to become the technical expert, But it really, I really found when I joined in Japan, the first day or the first week, I was told, don't be a law firm lawyer. We need a business lawyer in this company to be able to connect with the people in the business. So don't act like a law firm lawyer. I went in-house. Oh. So I realized then, well, I actually have to bring out some other skills rather than being a technical lawyer. So I think that's where it started to build relationships, connect with people, because I'm dealing with engineers and IP experts and marketing and sales teams. And so you can't speak legal lingo. So I think that's probably where it started, that I didn't have to lead like the men in the business. I could just be myself and bring out some of those innate skills that I have, but I didn't really realize until I became an in-house lawyer.
But that's amazing. That's definitely the exact opposite of what I hear that happens, obviously, here in the States. Like, there are not very many people are told to lead that way. That's like huge. And I think that actually would push people to understand. I think leadership also for women, obviously understanding that while we are still can be one way, we are empathetic. We do look at things at a different lens. And I think that there's a lot of limiting beliefs around leadership itself and being a CEO. And I think also being a lawyer and a CEO and a woman, those three things together. What do you think would be like the biggest limiting belief that you can't be those three things? And I know that it might be like, I'm a lawyer, I'm technical, I have this technical skill, but how do I add in those other two pieces, those other two roles?
Ooh, that's interesting. I think a lot of it comes down to confidence. And many people, I coach and mentor a lot of lawyers as well. And for me in my own business, can you do it? What am I to think I could be a CEO of a business? My own business, a law firm business. What are you thinking? And it's called imposter syndrome. I call it some self-doubt. But for me, I didn't really have that, because by the time I started my business, I had built this community of general counsels and lawyers in the community and business people who I knew would come to me. So for me, it was actually not a confidence thing, it's courage. So I believe courage comes first. If you've got the courage to actually start something and put fear over there in the passenger seat, and you put yourself with courage in the driver's seat, fear's never going to go. It's over there. And that's a good thing, I think, to a certain extent, and get going. Then confidence comes along the way. And so I don't know if that answers your question, but it's more about getting in there and not stopping yourself from starting and taking small steps. Yeah.
I agree. I think too, though, I think about like identity. I think we put a lot of women, you know, I'm a mom, I'm a business owner, I'm a lawyer. Like, there's like these separate pieces of us that if we identify as a lawyer, then we can't identify as a CEO, or we can't identify as, and I think that's a big part of evolving into, and maybe that's the confidence piece, because you have the courage, you started your firm, you had the courage to do that. Now it's the confidence to take a look at the identity as you're not just a lawyer anymore. And you're now a business owner, you're a CEO, you're a leader of team, you have to be a visionary. There's lots of, you know, pieces that go along with that.
Yeah. And I think perhaps because I've just been a bit different along the whole way. And so I call it a mosaic career. It's like different pieces of the mosaic are shaped differently, but they come together as one. So there are the parts that are the lawyer, that's one hat, the board roles, the podcast person. It's like, who's this crazy person doing all of this? But when you put the pretty pieces of the mosaic together, it's like, I see the pattern. It's all one. It just happens that you're not exactly one persona. You've got many. And I think that's the one thing that perhaps at law school we're never told or encouraged to be is more than one particular thing. You can be and, right? You can be the mom, you can be the lawyer, you can be actually whatever you want, the artist, the boutique owner, whatever it is.
I love that analogy of the mosaic, though, because you're putting together all of those pieces make up the whole picture. And so if we're not identifying with and putting all of those pieces together, then I think that's your picture's missing. You're not getting the full, it's like missing puzzle pieces.
Certainly is, right? Yeah.
Yeah. Oh my goodness. So I think when we talk about like leadership and we talk about leadership practices and frameworks, now you've always, like you said, have always had a different aspect and a different take. But for women who have not been pushed into that, maybe they're straight out of law school and they just open up their own business. and they don't have those frameworks or leadership practice, you know, built in already or had the opportunity to do it, where would you push them to kind of learn that? Or was there something specific for you that was like, this leadership practice is like what took me to the next level that they can start with even?
I think what helped me was when I left a corporate role and had that persona and became the CEO owner, I hired a business coach. And that was one of the biggest investments I could possibly do. And I feel some people restrain from getting some help in a more formalized way like that. But that changed my life, transformed me to thinking more broadly about those mosaic pieces, about being a leader, about being different, and that it was okay to. It took a while to actually get over that hump. It really did. And it doesn't happen overnight. But I think if people try to think about things differently, if you just see some of those luminous spark, like all of those sort of things, I'm always over in a blue, purple kind of area, which is very, that what you mentioned before about an A type. And the yellows and the greens, the softer areas were very minimal. Now, I've done that recently again, and the yellows and greens have built up, and blues and purples have gone a little bit softer. So you can change things if you work on it. Like if you are a good football player and you do nothing with it and you don't have a coach to help you, you're not going to excel to your best level. So I think that would be one thing, is getting in a coach to help you. You can't do it all yourself.
I think that when you say that, it brings up a lot for a lot of the members of our, you know, programs, and not all women, men as well, finally coming to the realization and being able to say it out loud, like, I am the bottleneck, I'm the problem, I'm here, I'm ready. Because I think before that, usually you get the people, I'm sure you've experienced this as well, that come in with good intentions to do the right thing and implement, and you know, they want to make, you know, they want the results, but they're not ready to make the change yet. They're just not ready to take the step that they need to push themselves to that next piece.
Yeah. And I think it's that switch to it. At the very beginning, I was very much in the business doing everything. And then when I finally realized I can't do all of this, I've actually got to execute as a practitioner, but also have the CEO hat. Someone else has got to do everything else for me. And so delegation is one of the major things. I see friends around me who have still held on to the invoicing. They want to bill their clients. They want to do these things. And I think that's just really not where our best effort can be put. But yeah, I think building the team, where you give them a lot of delegation. And I mean, by that, I mean, it's giving trust, right? Trusting them to do whatever they need to do. And often it's called, and I think it was my business coach called it, designing an alliance, where you know what you're able to do and your expectations on them, and give them flexibility, but also be open to the vulnerability that you don't know everything. And I've learned so much from my team, how to run a website, how to do this and that. And it's just been incredible to have that flex. But designing that alliance together makes you a really great team.
And I think like having the ability to, for me at least, it would be like letting go of the idea that how I would do it is not necessarily the way it needs to be done. It's still getting done. And just because I would do it differently doesn't mean it's done wrong. That's like such a huge, for me, that was such a huge part of letting go of delegation. It was like, but I want you to do it this way. Just because then for me, it was, that made it easier for me, but it didn't mean it was right. And I think that was a huge kind of challenge I had to navigate. So if there was one kind of navigation that you had to do for leadership and would it be, I don't know if it's delegation, it was delegation for me, but what would be kind of the first challenge that you had as it related to that?
I think it's the actual dedication to time to teach somebody what you've been doing.
Yes.
That is the hard, so much easier to just say, oh no, I'll keep doing it. So yeah, actually taking the time, and it is a time factor to do that and dedicate yourself to helping someone understand the process and why you do it, and letting it go, then you have liberation. But if you don't do that and you keep doing it, that's the hardest thing. So making time to invest in the person who's going to be helping you long term. At the front end, it feels very tough to do that. But once you do it, it's so liberating. Yeah, that would be the first thing.
I think that leads me into like the conversation I always love having, which is about like leading high performing teams, because I think a lot of that, if we don't let that go, there's no way for our team to be high performing. How they would do something quickly and efficiently is not the way we would do it. And so in order to scale in any kind of practice, whether you're a solo practitioner or whether you're working for a firm, you really have to be able to lead in that fashion. So do you have a specific approach that you take to developing and retaining your team and your talent?
I think if we're talking about leadership here, and I think it's not about control, it's about creating some energy that others want to move with. So if you want loyalty, I think you have to lead with trust and not tasks. So building that strong team I mentioned before starts with trust, and that begins even before hiring. I don't recruit through any formal way. I ask my trusted network, and then I'm bringing in people who are actually designed or aligned with me from the get-go. And I've also built this fractional model and hired people who are also fractional workers. So we live and breathe it, right? So they will bring their best time during the time they dedicate to me, but I give them space and ownership to go out and do the same for the other people that they help. So I think for retention and all of this that we're talking about, it's about that relationship. And I try to treat people as whole humans, not just professionals. We talk about families and goals and all that sort of thing as well. And I think that really, we think high performance teams may be about getting the KPIs and doing the financials. And those are important. But actually, no one's going to move with you if you haven't created that energy that allows people to move with you.
Yeah, I definitely agree. I learned from a boss a long time ago in corporate. I worked in construction for 20 years, but he was a New York, like traded lots of companies. So he was just very, very hard, like on people in general, but you wanted to work for him so much and you wanted to do well that it was that. It was what you bring to the team to, they want to do the work for you. They want to do it well. They want to show up. They want to excel. They want to go above and beyond. And that solely is about how you sit with them, how you treat them, how you respect them. And I say that all the time with the team now. I laugh when, you know, we start moving around and people start excelling and I want people to move up. And I'm like, but if you leave our little team bubble, you know what's going to happen. You're not going to have me. And then we all laugh because they're like, you don't know what it's like when you know, get that comfortableness. When you're like, I'm comfortable to do my job. I love it. And I excel in our department because I love that. And so I think that there's a big part of that that I think it's missing in a lot of, I don't even think just law firms, and a lot of businesses where they feel like, oh, I can't be friends with my team. And it's not friends. It just takes being human. I think you said being a human centric leader.
Exactly. And people talk about family and friends. Actually, I think it is about a community rather than being family and friend, because we can abuse those relationships because we take them for granted. But if you think of it as a community, then you treat things a little bit differently because you're investing and expecting that your contributions are going to make the community better, but it's not kind of friends or family as such. So I think there's a little bit of a distance if you say community, but it's not as intimate as friends or family. We're a family, we're friends. Yeah.
No, I agree. I think that that's we say the word team and I think that it gets used. Yeah. I think it's just used too much. I think it doesn't express it in the right way, especially when you're together and you're with each other a lot, even in the virtual sense, and we're not, you know, in offices anymore. It becomes more of a collaboration and more of a, I always tell everyone on the team, we used to have someone who, if something's going wrong, but nothing was going wrong with that person, they're like, well, you know, nothing's wrong with me. And I used to tell them, I'm like, if one of us is failing, we're all failing. Like, we collectively can't grow if we're failing. So you need to take a hard look at that. And sometimes it's hard for people to kind of see it in that way.
Yeah, good point. I mean, if you think of it as a sports team, though, too, if one team member is not able to kick the ball or make a try, you've got to, you know, it lets down the whole team. So you're right there with team analogy works to a certain extent, doesn't it? But
it's
not quite right. But there we go.
So if we shift and talk about strategy, because business needs strategy, we need implementation, we need strategy. But what is your approach to, you know, decision making and planning as you've evolved into you know, being a CEO, coming from a firm to a CEO, even though I know you started in looking at it like it's your business, I think there's probably an evolution of decision-making and planning.
Yeah, as I mentioned before, early on, I was so hands-on. But as I grew, I realized that really sustainable leadership is meant to be more deliberate and have really specific decision-making. And as I mentioned before about spending time to teach somebody, also needing to be spending time to be strategic was so important. So I allocate the right attention to different parts of the business, but to find the time annually to literally set up what's going to happen in the year, the big projects I want to do, the big rocks in the jar before the rest comes in. And being very, very strategic now on how I spend my time, making sure I'm actually doing what I'm meant to do over the business rather than doing all the rest of the work, and hiring in people who can help me now, contract workers who do a lot of the grunt, whereas I'm out there doing some of the, you know, scaling the leadership side of the business. So of course, there's some systems in place and guidebooks and playbooks to go by, but it's really trusting that the people who I've got in the business can do the work that I'm not going to be doing anymore, and giving them the freedom to keep going and come to me when they need to. And that's sort of really my model. It seems to work. It doesn't sound too concrete, and it's probably not an ABC, do this, that, and the other. But it's really moving from being hands-on to being very strategic has helped immensely.
I think the principle of keeping it simple always is always going to work, whether it's, you know, doesn't seem like it's, you know, structured. I think that it's still, if it's simple and it works, then it works. There's no reason to make it more complicated. And I think there's a really, really good piece for everybody to take in from that is making the time. Not just the time, but also the mental space to be proactive about strategic leadership and putting that time in there. There's so many people that all I see is putting out fires. And then when I sit down to have a conversation about what I always like to say is the boring, unsexy foundations, because nobody wants to talk about, okay, let's look at the quarter. Let's look at what are we doing next year? Let's look at our numbers. What do we need to do? And they're like, oh, it's like pulling teeth. And I'm like, I understand that this is like the unsexy, boring, unfun stuff, but it's the most important part of everything that you're doing as a leader. And making the time for it is one thing, but the mental space is
absolutely
the biggest part.
And I think too, the thing that I've heard recently is this PTUs, potential trip ups. Every morning, be really conscious that there could be 3 or 4 PTUs, you know, those fires that you're mentioning, potential trip ups that could come up. And if they do, well, you're kind of mentally spaced for it. Whereas if you don't, then you're not ready for it. And you talked about strategy with time, and calendar is so important. And I'd want to mention that because I think some people don't put it in the calendar. And if it's not there, it's actually not going to happen. So being very non-negotiable with some things, and it has to really...
I think that's the word, non-negotiable, because I'm also horrible at that. I put it on the calendar, but then those, I haven't used, learned that term before, but those PTUs, they're popping up while I have things on the calendar, and I'm willing to sacrifice myself and what's on my calendar for those things. And that's a very hard piece, especially when it's your team. If it's your team, it's like, there's an emergency. And I'm like, okay, well, my stuff gets pushed to the side so that I can, you know, assist on that. That is extremely hard for anyone, I would say. So what would be a tip that you could give for that? Because you're right, there's probably 40 things when you get up in the morning, as whether it's business, work, you know, mom, family. How do you take those on? Like, what is the way to deal with those?
I used to be very reactive, and what was in my calendar for me would go astray. Now I sort of do stop, think, act. So stop and think about what it is. Is it actually urgent? It feels urgent, but is it only urgent because that person thinks it's urgent? Is it really something that does need to be attention now? If it is, then act and help that person. If it's not, it might be acting by not acting, and in some other way delegating someone else to help or managing it in that way. But I think the important thing is not to react in the moment and just totally just let what you have astray. Actually do something strategically about the thing that's come up.
That's a great tip. Mm. I'm going to have to use that one for myself. Because that's one of my worst things. And I try, you know, you do those things at night. Before I go to bed, I check my calendar. So I know, like, mentally I'm prepared for what comes up in the day. And then I wake up and I'm like, I'm terrified to look at my phone because I don't know what come up. So it's going to screw all those things up.
Your night mantra can be, and what are potential trip ups for tomorrow? Okay. Someone might ring me about this, or something might happen that hasn't gone out as a deliverable and they're going to complain. Okay. That might happen. Da, 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 da. And you think about those. And then if they don't happen the next day,
great.
If they do, then you're like, it did happen. What am I going to do about it now? It's kind of a having fun with it in a way as well, that, what I predicted last night did happen. But I knew it was going to happen because I thought about it already. Even just that thought of it happening
yes.
can really change things because you've got a little bit of the mental piece built into that before you start to attack it, shall we say.
Yeah, no, that's amazing. I'm going to try that because I think you're right. The mental part is that, like, I'm mentally preparing for the next day, but I'm not mentally preparing for anything else, which
yes.
is the trip up. So we talk a lot about leadership in teams, but I'm curious, there's very little conversations, at least that I've heard, about how that leadership translates into clients, because we also can see a lot of lawyers who their client relationship is not good, whether it's one way or the other, whether, you know, they're taking on too much or not doing enough. How do you think that you've been able to shift, like, more from service provider to leader while still providing the best client service?
I think that's a really great question, because shifting from service provider to strategic leader means that the clients are evolving in their relationship with you as well. And I think now they really appreciate seeing the division of labor. They can see in that I am managing and being a strategic oversight for the work that is being done by someone else, a trusted lawyer that's doing the day-to-day execution. And I think that also frees them up to have a confidence that I'm closely following, but I'm not actually there all the time. And I believe that our check-in meetings become less frequent, but when they do, they're more meaningful. And I would say, clients don't expect me to be around all the time, but they know that they can contact me. So I don't make it that I'm available all the time. I don't hold myself out to that. But certainly if they contact me, I will make it look like I'm available, if that makes sense. I don't think they always need to know that you are on speed dial, but that you are available, but being very careful too about your boundaries for clients who expect you to be there for 24/7. I actually don't think I have clients like that, because I've already set the relationship up early on. And I think if you don't do that, things will bleed and you'll be there forever for them. So they're important to you, but also other people in your life are important to you as well, and yourself, right?
I think too, it's the mentality of, and I just used this analogy earlier today, but it's the Amazon mentality where we all want everything right now because we can have it right now. I can click it up, I can order it, I can have it at my house in an hour, or I can have it tomorrow. And I think people tend to then turn that into these type of, you know, business relationships, and I'm the client, so I have this expectation that I get what I need and instantaneous gratification. And I think that it's hard then, as you know, because those are the same people then that are going to give you reviews, and the last thing that you want to do is have something negative because of something like that. And so I think it's such a hard boundary that gets crossed all the time. I think it happens too much.
Interesting. I hadn't heard it called that, but it is this instantaneous gratification society we're in now. So how you tackle that is extremely important. And that's like the stop, think, act before, is that you slow that down a bit, the reactive piece. And you think in yourself, I've got to do this now. I have to do this now. But if you try it, you can find out that actually it's okay not to do it so immediately, but be still not non-responsive, but be just slow it down a bit. And that can actually be to your advantage because you have time to think about it as well.
I think you touched on this a little bit too, is having given the authority and the power to someone within your team, and being really upfront out of the chute with a client saying, while I might not be available to answer your questions, certainly this person on the team will be available. They'll be able to get back to you, even if it's a response of, you know, I'll get back to you tomorrow with a response. You'll never not be answered. It just maybe, you know, that set up in that way. I think sometimes people just want to know that there's somebody there. My first experience with an attorney was a couple years ago. That was the biggest thing for me. I didn't expect to be able to have, you know, a straight phone line to him constantly, because that's completely ridiculous. But when you don't get a response, when you email and it's days and you're like, what's happening? I think that's the, there's like one way and then the complete opposite way. So not being where your boundaries completely cross, but then also understanding that you are providing a service that you still have to provide.
Exactly. And I think it's on you. You set up how you expect people to treat you. So if you don't respond, then they're going to have that this person's unresponsive. But if you have the system where you do quickly say, thanks for your contact, I'll get back to you by end of week, or let me know if it's even you need something faster. If you do have that cadence, you're respected for that. If you don't have it, then people will walk all over you. So you've got to set it up. It's on you. You can't blame a client for always contacting me, always in my pocket. There's a way of dealing with that, and it actually is on us. We've got to do that. Yep.
I agree 100%. So the next thing I love talking about, but I feel like it's a taboo kind of, a lot of lawyers, I'm not sure, Nira, but in the US,
like that kind of might be about money.
Yes. I always say financial, the numbers. When I first started coaching lawyers, for me, it was every quarter, I was like, let's have a financial audit. I think I terrified them by using the word financial audit. It wasn't, I'm not your CPA. I'm not, you know, that's not the conversation they were having, but I couldn't even get them to come on a call because they're like, I don't talk about my numbers. I don't know what my numbers are at the end of the year. And I'm like, that's not the way you function as a CEO, as a business owner. We have to talk about our numbers. We have to know what where our target goal is. If we're meeting it, we're, you know, we can't wait until it's the end of the year and go, well, crap, you know, we're in the hole. Like, that's not the way to run a business. So for you, what was the shift? Like, that is another shift from practitioner, service provider to leader, to understand that that's a huge, most important piece of your business and being a CEO.
Yeah, I think hiring a CPA at the very beginning was important, and not just saying, thanks so much, you do everything great, I'll just do this other stuff, the legal stuff, and having conversations with them and working out what is a better way to manage things. And the other thing, maybe it's too hands-on, but I actually find doing my own expenses and being just a little bit in control of calculating those, I see how much I'm physically spending. And I find that quite useful as a leader to know where I can day by day make some changes. So that's something I do on that sort of absolute financial area, right? Obviously, my accountant does everything else. I put all the invoices into a Google Drive. They get all the work was done. But for the first few years, I did my tax returns. And I was actually very proud as a lawyer who doesn't normally care about numbers, I was able to do my finances like that. And then it just got too much, too many clients, too much to handle. And I had to hand it through to someone who could do that. So to that extent, though, I still do a little bit of my expenses now because I like to see where it's going. But I think leadership doesn't just increase revenue. It also expands your influence and your impact. So for me, there's a profitability that's not in a financial sense as well. It's also being invited to do things, being visible so that you're also invited. And that eventually leads to remuneration, financial income. So sometimes it's not only the physical work we are doing day to day as a lawyer. There might be occasions where we're asked to be on a podcast like this or to be on stage. And then that leads to people seeing you. Who is this person? What do they do? And asking you to do more that leads to something that will be a compensation for you. So, you know, that's what I've found. And I find that being visible is part of being financial well-being in the end.
I think too, I looked at, because I just happened to have done this last week, but looking at numbers quarterly and having them on a sheet and then asking the questions that they wouldn't ask, like, you know, why this quarter do you have $20,000 in expenses more than you had last quarter? And then having the lawyer go, look at the accountant and go, you know, their in-house, you know, accountant and go, okay, well, what happened? And I'm like, these are things that you should just inherently know. You have these meetings, ask the questions. And then there are basic things that come up and you're like, oh yeah, I forgot about that. And I forgot about this. And I forgot we had that. Like, these are things that have to be thought about and calculated in when we look at what's happening next year. So being aware of what's going on and being aware, are we at where we're supposed to be at? Like, we're halfway through the year. Are we meeting our revenue goals? Are we lax? Are we going to have to pick up at the back half of the year? Are we going to be able to relax and say, you know, wow, we're almost there. And so are we going to have an easier back half of the year? Are we going to, you know, there's just so many things and so many strategies that you can create from that, even for yourself personally, that it's so important, I think, as a leader to be a part of all of the data and the decision-making, even if it's something that you don't love doing.
Yeah. And I think that's so important what you're saying, and that it might have sounded like I don't do any of that tracking. I certainly do. And tracking essentials like the client retention, average engagement size, time versus the value created, all of those lenses I do use as well. But a lot of it is metrics is also how I've changed lives, how the client has been at the beginning of the year and how they are at the end having contact with me, what contact with me has made a difference for them. So some of those non-financial KPIs I also monitor as well.
I love those. And I think those are ones that you can monitor with your team, because those are shared. We're super excited. You know, this is what we did for our client. I mean, you assisted on this. We all created this result for them, that I think it's important to share in those, because it's a team effort, especially for, you know, some of our larger firms that have very large teams with paralegals and intakers. Like, they're an integral piece from the beginning to the end. So sharing those, you know, are super important.
Absolutely. And I mean, for you, they're leading the business. Revenue is the result, but leadership is the cause, right?
Yeah.
You've been the one that's been leading that team to get to that result. Mm.
So practically, I'm a super implementation person. Like, I want everybody to always listen to a podcast that I've done and be able to take an action step, regardless of what it is. It could be, you know, in your business, maybe it's a mindset. There's always something that we want to be able to do afterwards to make the time that you spend worth it. There's an ROI from it. So for the women listening who recognize that they need to make a leadership shift, but don't know where to start, what would you say would be like the one thing they could do tomorrow?
I love this question. I think you have to start where you are with what you have, use what you have, and trust what you know. Like, just, you talked about first steps. Take one, even the smallest action. I've got a client who is now building a website, and they just tried to think about colors. And that was their first task. And it feels meaningless. Maybe it does, but it's actually meaningful, right? It's the first step. I think the door to leadership is always marked push. No one opens it for you. No one's coming to tell you you're ready. You have to decide that you're ready enough. Being ready is a decision. It's not a feeling. And so I think also too, listen for a whisper that you might hear, something that's nudging you. And if you're already feeling that, then I think you're already ready. Can I say that? Trust it, you know, and take that step. And if you stumble, it's not a failure. That's leadership in motion, I believe. Every misstep is a lesson. Every lesson takes you further. So I don't think you have to wait to be chosen. You set the stage for yourself. But if you don't take a step, you're never going to go on that 1,000-mile journey, which I think is a Japanese saying, right? The 1,000-mile journey starts with the first step. So that would be my first thing, is take that step, have confidence to do the tiniest thing, and then build on that. And maybe that's a well-worn piece of advice, but it certainly is true. And that's what's helped this website builder, who's never done one before, a lawyer, take those first steps to work out colors and fonts. And now it's, right, what's the content? But what do I do for the first bit about myself? Someone else can write something about me, perhaps, instead of me writing it myself. So those are little steps that you can do.
I think when I think about that, I think taking the first step, and if somebody's struggling with that, my response is, not taking a step is taking a first step. That's the step you're choosing to take. And so for me, that's a decision you've made not to move forward. And that is clearly not what we want. So when I think when you present it that way, it kind of people tend to freeze and be like, you're right. Okay. Anything. And so, like you said, anything that you wake up tomorrow morning that was something that you felt like you needed to do, you couldn't do, you want to do as a leader, not as a technical expert, which is, you know, being the lawyer and doing every single day, that one thing, if you just do that, as small as it might seem, I think that's the, you know, snowball rolling down the hill.
Yes, yes, you got it. Wow. Whew. I want to work for you.
I don't know if you said some of them, I always laugh and I say, it might be a little mean, but we get it done. So final question. And I want to leave this series for women. We've had a lot of different conversations throughout this series, but the biggest thing is understanding what becomes possible for women in law, because I look at and I'm part of a lot of groups for girls that are just starting law school or just graduating. And listening to the things that they say. And the biggest thing is, I think, obviously, having a mentor to see a woman who's doing what's possible, that's not defining themselves just as a lawyer, that's embracing their power as a leader, that's being visionary. What is it that opens up for women that are willing to do that?
Everything changes. When women stop defining themselves as just technical expertise owners alone, and they start embracing their power as a visionary leader, they move, I think, well, we move from passion through to purpose, passion for the law to actually purpose of what we're doing on this planet. We stop waiting for direction and we actually start to shape it. And for some, that might mean changing lives through major causes. For me, it's helping people to be a better version of themselves with a lot of the coaching and mentoring I do. So when we lead as visionary women, I think we don't just change law firms and our teams. We change lives, we change industries, we change legacies for others. And that's what becomes possible. So when you think of being a technician doing the law, getting the work out the door, this is far bigger. We're building a future. And I think leadership's not a title, it's a decision you make. So the moment you stop saying, I'm just a lawyer, and give yourself permission to start leading, everything changes, your opportunities, your influence, your legacy. And I think people are not just here as women, for example, to be lawyers. We're here to really change things.
Yes, that is powerful. I think that's the challenge that I want to leave every single woman who's listening, who's listened to this whole series with, is just prioritize that heart of becoming that leader. And maybe it is the confidence piece. Maybe that is the one step that you're going to take tomorrow that feels uncomfortable, is that little bit of confidence that you need to feel like you're in that role to do the thing that puts you in that role. Maybe it's not, you know, a physical thing that you need to do. Maybe it's wake up tomorrow and the thing that I'm doing that's putting me the action step is being confident today that I am the CEO.
Yeah. I mean, be confident, have the courage to push that door, walk through it, become the leader you've been waiting for. I can say quickly, one stage in my life, I was told I was not a leader. And I've disproved that, right? I am a leader, but there's just different ways to lead. And perhaps that person's version A, I was version B or C or D differently. So there are different ways to be a leader, but be that leader that you have been waiting to be. Go ahead and do it.
Powerful. I appreciate you coming out with this conversation. This was a powerful conversation to have at the end of this series. And I think everyone who listened to the entire series, we're obviously going to have more of these, especially, you know, dedicated to women, but this was super powerful and I appreciate it.
Thank you very much. It's been a lot of fun and I learned a lot from you too. Thank you very, very much.
Oh yes, me too. I'm going to do the CPU thing and the before I go to bed thing. That is my one thing for tomorrow.
Yes. Potential PTUs, right? Potential trip ups.
Trip ups. I was going to say trigger ups, but
also it could trip me up. It's also good to claim it, make it your own. Yeah.
Could be ups. No more trip me ups.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening to The Law Entrepreneur. If you found value in the show, please rate, review, and subscribe on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you're listening. And don't forget to share the episode with a friend. It could help transform their life. To get access to a treasure trove of exclusive free resources for lawyers, go to joinlawyerclub.com. Again, That's joinlawyerclub.com. We'll see you on the next episode.